questions. I mean,
that's okie dokie. Okie dokie. Hopefully we're all a little bit re-energized. All right, so we're going to do something a little, we're going to do something a little different in this session. We're going to, in a few minutes, we're going to get into some Torah text, which is really the foundation of all this stuff. It's interesting. If you talk to the founders of the State of Israel in the late 19th, early 20th century, and you told them it all went back to the Torah, they would say, well, you're crazy, you know, we're secular, it has nothing to do with that. But the truth is, the ideas permeate throughout Jewish history, and they come down to our day as well. We already spoke a little bit about the concept of Zion and Zionism. Is it secular or is it religious? And I think our conclusion was it was both. Is that correct? Right. It's, you know, some one thing to one people, one person, another to another person. But we know that the concept of Zionism is replete in the Tanakh. What's Tanakh? Anybody? Torah, prophets, and writings. Yeah, Nevi'im, Ketuvim, the Tanakh. It's the abbreviation for it. All right, then, in case some of you don't know it. Tanakh. That's basically a way of saying all the ancient Jewish writings. Or at least most of the ancient Jewish writings. When I say that the concept of Zion is replete in Tanakh and our liturgy, I want to give you some examples so you really see it. What do we say when we take out the Torah? Finish this? Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah. From Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah, because from Zion goes forth the Torah. Devar Adonai Mi Yerushalayim, and the word or the thing of God from Jerusalem. Ki Mitzion Tetzei Torah. In the Shacharit Amida, we say, Matai Timloch Letzion, when will you come to Zion? Bikarob Beyameinu, speedily in our days. Birkat HaMazon, we say, Shivat Zion Hayinu Kecholmim, we were as dreamers remembering Zion. And that's going to come up in one of our text readings today. Anyone know any others? Anything come to mind? The word Zion, Zion? It's in the Tuesday Psalm, for example. We say daily Psalm each day. If you particularly take a look whenever you get a chance through the prophets, you see Zion and Jerusalem left and right. You can't get away from it. And we already talked about what we say at the end of the Passover Seder. The famous wedding song, Uvechutzot Jerusalem, from the outskirts of Jerusalem. And Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Everybody know that song? Jerusalem of Gold? It's a beautiful, beautiful song. And again, keep in mind that we're mixing Zion and Jerusalem, Zion and Jerusalem, Yerushalayim. By the way, I'll sin for you. Zion in English is one thing. Zion in Hebrew is a male and an anatomical part. It's not Zion, Zion.
Zion.
Zion. Zion. Yeah, Zion is written like this. That means Zion. So that's why if you are learning Hebrew and you want
don't
to talk to somebody,
Zion.
Right, we'll erase that. We don't need to see that. I made a big mistake once in Israel when I was talking. So
are you equating Zion equals Jerusalem?
Yes, yes. In our course, Zion, and in our ancient text, Zion equals Jerusalem.
It's Jerusalem. It's another way.
It's another way of saying it. Right. And again, you know, Zion in the modern term means all of the land of Israel. And at various points in Jewish history, it means that as well. But it specifically means Jerusalem, and it specifically within Jerusalem means the Temple Mount. And it specifically within the Temple Mount, it means that the one spot, which we really don't know where it is, where Abraham almost sacrificed Isaac. Anybody ever been inside the Dome of the Rock? So you've seen they have a spot there that's smoothed
out.
A big
outcropping, a big white rock.
Right, it's a smooth spot. It's hard to recognize it now, but the old city of Jerusalem and the Temple Mount in particular is built on a mountain. So there you see the rock that's the foundation underlying it. You get a better picture of it if you go to the city of David Dig, which is on the side, which is at the eastern side of the city, sloping down the hill. All right. When we say, we covered that. Religious Jews, I wanted to mention too, pray for the rebuilding of the temple three times a day, the rebuilding of Jerusalem three times a day, in a paragraph at the end of the Amidah. All right, so where specifically is Zion? It's specifically the site in Jerusalem, which I just spoke about, but it's also the site where King David bought the land from Uriah, from the Hittite. It wasn't Uriah the Hittite. It was from, it was, what, I don't have his name down here. Well, he, the Jebusite. What was the guy's name? It escapes me right now. Sorry about that. King David had to buy the land after a bloody battle to take Jerusalem, which was a Jebusite fortress. Aruna, from Aruna the Jebusite. Because King David couldn't conquer the land, he had to pay for it in as a good faith bargain, because it would have been an offense to God. By the way, has anyone ever been to Mount Zion in Jerusalem? It's just outside the walls of the old city. Well, guess what? That's not the right spot, like many other things. Although there's a grave there that they say it's King David.
Right.
I guess it's not. It's probably not. Just like many things. Yeah?
Speaking of references to places,
That's a great question. The thing is, in almost every city in Israel, you can find an archaeological dig. Jerusalem's ancient. Most of the ones on the West Bank are ancient. Tel Aviv is absolutely new in terms of ancient. Haifa is new. Akko is pretty old. There's not too much on the coast that's old.
There is something in the something where it's from Dan to Beersheba.
Yeah,
those are ancient cities.
Right.
Dan in the north, Beersheba in the south.
Right. Right, Beersheba is obviously an ancient city. Abraham was there, and certainly.
Well, how about Jaffa?
Jaffa is pretty old. Jaffa was in it was in Phoenicia, but
well, the concept is if you talk about the coast, none of the coast, which is essential mm-hmm. for the survival of Israel. Is old Hebrew.
Right.
It's
Phoenician.
Jerusalem.
Right. Well, Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, is the heartland. That's the biblical heartland.
Well, the cities of the Philistines, right? I mean, Jaffa, Ashkelon,
Gaza, right. Yeah, so they're ancient. They're not necessarily Jewish, some of them, like Gaza. Gaza, although Jews always lived in Gaza. Right? We know that from Shabtai Tzvi, the false Messiah. All right. The word Zion, where does it come from? It's probably comes from an ancient Hebrew word, Sion, S-I-Y-Y-O-N, or the Hebrew Sia, S-I-Y-Y-A, which means dry land. And that's mentioned in Jeremiah 51:43, if you want the reference. Zion is mentioned more than 100 times in the Torah alone. All right. We also see references to Mount Zion, the daughter of Zion, the virgin daughter of Zion, and then, of course, just plain Zion. The first reference to Zion in the text is 2 Samuel 5:7, and it says, "Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David." Now, as we mentioned, the city of David and Zion are interchangeable, and the same with Jerusalem. There's a famous reference, by the way, that I forgot to mention. "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down, yea, and wept when we remembered Zion." Psalm 137. We're going to get to the whole text of that in a little bit. Bat Zion appears 26 times. It means Har Moriah, or Mount Moriah, which is next to it, which is the Temple Mount. It's next. There's a small mountaintop known as Zion, and there's a small mountaintop known as the Temple Mount, or Har Moriah. Mount Moriah. All right, let's do a little text work. We're going to talk a little bit about the special meaning of being a Jewish nation. And this really is something that we need to follow through with when we come into our modern writings. That's why we're going through it. All right, can I get a volunteer to read? Actually, hang on a second. I have some additional readings here. I have some. Let's not go to that yet. What is the Torah about? Anybody? What's the Torah about? Depends what book you're reading. What's the whole thing about, though?
Jewish history.
The history
of the world up until.
It's about
Jews get to.
Their relationship to God.
It's about giving a people a purpose.
Yeah.
That's the main underlying theme of the Torah. It gives an ancient people a purpose. And that purpose becomes pretty clear. In Exodus 19:6, it says, some of you have heard this before, "You will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." It's pretty basic, pretty straightforward. The central purpose of being Jewish in an ancient world is faith to God, and in particular, it's a particular charge to the Jews. All right? The Torah is about you should be kind to the stranger, and it's got all this other stuff, but it's really about giving a nation a purpose. Deuteronomy 4:19, it says, "Beware lest you raise your eyes to heaven, and when you see the sun and the moon and the stars, all the hosts of the heaven, you be drawn away and bow down to them and serve them, things that the Lord your God has allotted to all the people under the whole heaven." That means you're different. Watch it. You've got a distinct responsibility. And that's something that's going to drive this story as well. The text unequivocally declares that God loved Zion. There's no question whatsoever. In Psalm 78:68, he says, "He chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved." And in 87:2, he says, "The Lord loves the gates of Zion more than all the dwellings of Jacob." That's pretty heavy stuff that he's getting into there. All right. We talked a little bit about the importance of the land in the text. Let's give the examples. Abraham is told to go where? Where's Abraham told to go? He wasn't married yet. He's to leave your home and your parents to go to the land of Israel, or the land of Canaan, as it's called then. And then when he gets there, he's told that it's his and his descendants for all time. Right? That's, in a nutshell, the promise. That's the biblical promise that's going to drive everything for us. Until, again, we get to the modern era and we get to secularism. When he journeys to Egypt. He and others journey to Egypt at various times in the text. But they all come back to Israel. The land of Israel. Joseph's bones are taken back to Israel when the Israelites leave there. And it's in a famous passage. We talked a little bit about King David. Kings will rule in Jerusalem. Jewish kings, or Israelite kings, we're using Israelite and Jewish interchangeably, are going to rule from the land of, are going to rule from Jerusalem from Abraham's, not from Abraham's time, from King David's time, which is roughly 1000 to 568 BCE. That's a pretty long run. Then they're going to rule there again from roughly 145 or 46 until about 70. Until about, really 67, but till about 70. And we talked about the Torah and what it really symbolizes. I have a question for you to think about too. Is the Torah a book about nationalism?
Only when you get to Shemot.
Only when you get to Shemot. Talk about the whole thing in general. And what are the nationalist aspects of the Torah? I'll give you a hint. First of all, it's in a language. It spreads a language, right? And a key element of nationalism is language, right? It talks about the borders of your land.
A value system.
Rules and regulations.
So it has politics.
Definitely has politics in there. Talks about choosing a king, for example. It tells you what you can eat. It tells you who you can marry. It tells you where you're supposed to live. It's one of the most, you know, in some regards, this is a real blaspheme, it's no different than the Communist Manifesto, right? It's a doctrine to live by. It's a book of nationalism. It's a guidepost for the nation. Now,
it also introduces a concept of morality.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And now it's a unique book of nationalism, and it's a book of religious nationalism as well. There's no doubt about it that it's religious-centered. Let's read a little of the text now. Can I get a volunteer to read Deuteronomy 31? Anybody? Yeah, I teach English high school, so I know how hard it is to get volunteers. Yeah.
"And Moses wrote the law and delivered it unto the priests, the sons of Levi, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and unto all the elders of Israel. Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, in the feast of tabernacles, all Israel is come to appear before the Lord thy God in the place which he shall choose, all before all Israel in their hearing. Gather the people together, men and women and children, that their children which have not known anything may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God as long as you live in the land whither you go over Jordan to possess it.
Okay.
Does the word fear mean fear, or does it have another?
Fear is yirah, which is really all reverence for the heavens. Yirah, like yirah hashemayim, or yiras hashemayim, however you say it. So there's a different. It's not a good English translation. Reverent awe would be the best, would be the best translation. So what's going on here? There's a lot of stuff in this. What's going on here? Let me get us started. Read the law before all Israel in their hearing. You're supposed to make sure that everybody hears this law. This law is not supposed to be kept to yourself. This is something that's supposed to be read, transmuted to all the generations. Why you do that? It's an obvious reason, so everybody understands it, so it's easier to live it. In a sense, that's a step toward democracy, in that everybody hears the law and will know that they have to be held accountable toward it. And anything else going on here?
When you talk about the law, this is general for the Torah?
Yes, yes. By the way, what does Torah mean? The teaching. The teaching or the law. Absolutely. Gather the people together. Everybody needs to come together. This is a uniting event. This is an event that's going to bring people together. The Torah is meant to be heard by everybody. Let's see. And look who you gather. Men, women, and children, and the stranger. Even the stranger that's within the gates, or within your midst, as it often says in the text. So you're going to have to hold them accountable to certain laws, too, and they're going to gain certain protections as well. And that the children, which have not known anything, may hear and learn to fear the Lord your God. Again, that's the reverence and awe for God. But this is important to pass on to the children here, too. So this is really a book of about religious nationalism. Now, there's also a horrible price to pay for being unfaithful to God. And that's where we're going to need somebody to read the next one. Somebody else? David?
So the Lord brought the king of Babylon against them, the Babylonians. Killed Judah's young men, even chasing after them into the temple. They had no pity on the people, killing both the young men and young women, old and the infirm. God handed all of them over to Nebuchadnezzar. The king took home to Babylon all the articles, large and small, used in the temple of God, and the treasures from both the Lord's temple and from the palace of the king and his officials. Then his army burned the temple of God, tore down the walls of Jerusalem, burned all of the palaces, and completely destroyed everything of value. The few who survived were taken as exiles into Babylon. They became servants to the king and his sons until the king of Persia came to power. So the message of the Lord spoken through Jeremiah was fulfilled. The land finally enjoyed its Shabbat rest, laying desolate until the 70 years were fulfilled, just as the prophet had said.
All right. Any reactions to what's going on here? Not a pretty picture.
Babylonian exile.
Babylonian exile.
It tells you what happens if you don't do what you're supposed to.
Exactly. Not a pretty picture. And look who's
rationalization.
Exactly. God handed all of them over to Nebuchadnezzar, right? So who's responsible in the big picture?
God.
God's responsible for everything. And his army burned the temple of God. God's even willing to allow his own temple to be burned. That's how angry God's going to be if you don't listen to the laws. That's pretty serious stuff. But here's an interesting thing. The few who survived, there will be survivors. This is a constant theme in Jewish history. You're going to get later on in the text, Isaiah speaks of the great downfall, and he winds up naming, I think it's his third child, out of three, She'eret Yeshuv, a remnant shall remain. So there always will be survivors. And what was spoken through Jeremiah was fulfilled. The word of God is true. That's what you're supposed to get from this text. All right, the prophet Micah then goes and tells us the way it's supposed to be. All right, someone want to read Micah? Yeah? Okay.
In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains, vaulted above the hills, and peoples will stream to it. Many nations will come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. We'll judge between many peoples and will settle disputes for strong nations far and wide. They will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Everyone will sit under their own vine and under their own fig tree, and no one will make them afraid, for the Lord Almighty has spoken. All the nations may walk in their name of their gods, and we will walk in the name of the Lord our God forever and ever.
Very nice. So Micah tells us the way it's supposed to be. It's a messianic vision for sure. Some of you notice in here, nation shall not take up sword against nation. That's the famous Lo Yisagoya Goy Cherev, right? Which we sing at the end when we take the Torah back sometimes. So in that, the Torah service, that part of the section. Again, many nations will come and say, come let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. There's that focus on that one spot. That repeated focus on that one spot. The law will go forth, will go out from Zion. Ki mitzion teitse Torah. Udvar Adonai miYerushalayim. The word of the Lord from Jerusalem. It's always kind of neat. I always enjoy when I'm looking at this stuff and I discover something that's in prayers that I've been saying. I say, wow, that's where it comes from. Who knew? Because when you pick up the text, you know, you say to yourself, this is one long book. You know, this is, I really don't know what's going on here. It's very complicated. So I always get a little joy out of that. All right. Now we're going to talk about the theme of return in Jewish texts. Because this theme of return underlies the concept of returning to the land of Israel. Because what our early Zionists did in the modern era is they took all these ancient Hebrew, ancient Jewish longings and secularized them, but you know, many of them actually came from traditional Jewish homes. They were just secular in how they lived their lives as adults, and they applied that to their actions as Zionists. So this theme of return we'd mentioned earlier tonight, this comes up after the Babylonians conquered Judea. That was actually in 641. And the Judeans were exiled to Babylonia, but the seeds were planted for Jewish thought and Jewish longing. So let me get somebody else to read. What's going on here, by the way, is these are the exiles in Babylonia. And this is really one of the most famous and beautiful poems in Jewish history. Yeah.
By the rivers of Babylon we sat and wept when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps. For there our captors asked us for songs. Our tormentors demanded songs of joy. They said, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a foreign land? If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget it still. May my tongue cling to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, I do not consider Jerusalem my highest joy. Remember, Lord, what the Edomites did on the day Jerusalem fell. Tear it down, they cried. Tear it down to its foundations. Daughter Babylon, doomed to destruction, happy is the one who repays you according to what you have done to us. Happy is the one who seizes your infants and dashes them against the
rocks. Kind of a sad ending, not to say the least. You know, most people never get to that part. They do the by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept. Very famous. What it really talks about is a longing to return and how crucial it is to finally, eventually, return to Jerusalem, the land of Israel, what have you. And this is very famous too, by the way. If I forget you, Jerusalem, may my right hand forget its skill, my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. We're going to find out that in 1903, Theodor Herzl famously had to say that to the World Zionist Congress because the cultural Zionists were so upset that he was promoting a Jewish homeland in Uganda, of all places, which is actually East Africa, Kenya, probably today. And to convince them that he had not abandoned the Jewish faith, he said, okay, I'll, you know, pass on that, and if my let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth and my right hand forget its cunning, if I forget you, Jerusalem. So, you know, they do know this stuff, and it does matter. All right, Ezekiel, however, foretells of the return. It's a little happier story. One final reader? Anybody? Jill? Nope.
Jerusalem, on whom shall the ruined cities be?
Okay, so finally we have a happy ending. But again, we see that God's presence and God's rule is going to be the most important underlying thing. So what we just did here is we went through the text and we found out the reasonings as to why Zion, the land of Jerusalem, the land of Israel, Jerusalem, the power of the belief in God, how that drove the ancient Israelites in all their beliefs. And this stuff wasn't just suggestions, right? This wasn't recommended behavior. This is what you did if you were part of the people, whether you liked it or not. I'm guessing that some didn't like it, but it didn't really matter at that point. All right. So now what we've talked about is the importance of the need to return and the focus of return. And that's going to be something that's going to stay with the Jewish people all through Jewish history until this very moment, indeed. And it's interesting. If we were doing the second course, which is 48 forward, we would be doing a whole unit on what it means to be a Zionist today and whether or not you have to actually live in the land of Israel to be a Zionist, as many people believe you do. Not many, some. Mostly those people in Israel because they made their choice. But for these people, you had to. That's what it was about. That was the underlying factor. All right. And they did come home for the first time in 538 BCE. Cyrus the Great, the Persian, defeated the Babylonians. And he was the one who issued a proclamation allowing the people of Judah to go home if they chose to. Not all of them chose to go. They came in waves. Initially, 50,000 of them, led by the prophet Zerubbabel, returned. 50,000 is a lot of people, yeah.
This may be a little off topic, but just to what is known about the way that bites, let's say, were rolled in Babylon, so this sense of national identity,
right,
or, you know, this identity strengthened rather than kind of dissipated?
Right. Well, like most ancient peoples, they were basically allowed to do what they wanted to do as long as they paid taxes and, you know, basically said, you know, we're ruled by somebody else. They were ostensibly left alone.
They were not enslaved?
They weren't enslaved there. The ones who stayed in the land of Israel had a particularly rough time at that point. But no, I don't believe that they were enslaved.
A lot of that depended on the political system of the country.
Absolutely.
The Babylonians believed that you conquer a country, you flatten it out, and you move everybody back to
Babylon. You exile them, right.
Whereas the Persians believed that you got more flies with sugar than you do vinegar. And
right.
Let people stay in their own homeland, as long as they behave themselves and paid their taxes, they could be their own kind of people in their own land.
Right.
That's why the Persians allowed them to return.
And the Romans, we'll see, would wind up doing the same exact thing. You know, basically, if you were send your taxes in, and although the Romans started doing some crazy things, like putting, you know, they tried to put a temple, a statue to Zeus in the temple in Jerusalem, and that drove the Jewish zealots crazy. I can't remember. It might have been Caligula. Wouldn't be surprising if it were, to say the least. All right. But per David's point, Nebuchadnezzar, who was the Babylonian, had a particularly brutal occupation of the land of Israel. He destroyed the temple, of course. That's par for the course in the ancient world. Then King Zedekiah was forced to watch his two sons killed, and then his eyes were put out. And he was actually sent with the exiles over to Babylon, and his grandson actually came home. The books of Ezra and Nehemiah tell this story the best. In 538, the Babylonian Jews were allowed to return, thanks to what's called Cyrus's decree. He said the Jews could worship the Jewish God, and they would have their semi-autonomy, just along the lines of what David was saying. Interestingly enough, most stayed in Babylon. That's an interesting parallel to today, right? Most stayed in Babylon. Like I said, 50,000 went back. That's not necessarily a small number. But this semi-autonomy lasted for about two centuries until the Greeks would come into the picture. Now, the Zion returnees, as they're called, set up the first quasi-independent Jewish state. It was called Yehud Medinata. Let me write that on the board here.
Yehud, which means Judea or Jewish. Medinata means state. Now, the interesting thing about Yehud Medinata is that, very much like Israel today, I would argue, it was the first time that a Jewish state had to be pressured, live with the pressure of outside rulers. And there's, if anybody thinks that the state of Israel doesn't live with pressure from the United States or, you know, some European countries or the European Union, then they're certainly wrong. It was a small piece of territory. It contained Jerusalem and Judea. So it wasn't Israel as we think of it today. It was a relatively small area. One of the first things they did was they laid the cornerstone for the new temple. And indeed, they would go ahead and wind up building the new temple. The second temple, not the new temple. So that's when that came into fruition. They even issued small coins with Yud-Hey-Dalet on it, or YHD on it. Nationalism at play here. That's one of the key signs of nationalism, is having your own coins. And we're going to study that in one of our sessions, too. They settled mostly in villages. Jerusalem was the only site which was a city of note. There was a significant number of religious returnees who came back with Ezra and Nehemiah in a later exile, and that was really a problem because they had found that the initial returnees who had come back were a little lax on things like intermarriage and observing Jewish statutes and what have you, and it created great tension, just like we're going to see happens in the modern era, when different waves or different aliyot of immigrants who come in are going to clash with the previous ones and vice versa. This was a state ruled internally by a governor and high priest. It was subservient to Persia. Nehemiah totally comes in and he totally rejects the Samaritans who were there. It's a group of people who are similar to the ancient Israelites. There still are some Samaritans in Israel today. He says, we don't want your help, particularly in building the Temple Mount. It's all a mirror of the modern day. That actually takes us up to where I want it to be for now. So, yeah.
When was the Babylonian Talmud
written? The Babylonian Talmud was finished in 500, 450, 500.
So it was after
when
they came back?
Yeah, it was after the next exile. It was about 200 to 500. I think the Mishnah was primarily codified then. Right, so, but then with the Gemara, 200 to 500 was when they finished it. Yeah.
Why isn't Cyrus more revered?
That's a good question. I'm not really sure. He just never caught. You know, he's no Judah the Maccabee or anything like that. Certainly, yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah. All right. If I were to start reading, I know you guys have 8 books. So if I were to start reading, I would start reading probably the David Engel's book, which is the smaller one on, what's, I think it's just called Zionism?
Yes, Zionism.
Zionism. That's an excellent, excellent overview. Now, a lot of that stuff we're not going to get to really the fourth lecture. A lot of the stuff in the early stuff that I'm talking about, there's no text for it. So, you know, you have a chance to catch up in your reading as well. So I've covered a lot tonight. Are there any questions? Any additional questions, I should say. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed. I really appreciate your time. And, yeah?
Don't we meet here?
No, we're not meeting in this room. We're meeting
in the Schuster Library.
Yeah, on our way out, you'll see it on your left.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mitch has something he wants to mention.
No, I don't want to do anything that's going to interrupt this course, but two Tuesday nights on October 29th, the Friends of Israel Defense Forces were having our annual gala. So the purpose of FIDF is to support the humanitarian, social, educational needs of Israeli soldiers. So if anybody is interested in attending or making a donation, let me know and I'll get you an invitation and all the information that's involved with it.
Okay. Thank you. All right, next week we're going to get into the Middle Ages.
Now, see, when we get to the more modern stuff, we're going to start to watch some videos, and it'll lighten it up a little. But you have to get this foundational understanding first to really dig in and understand the roots of what happens when we get to the modern era. So I thank you for your patience.
Thank you. In the Middle Ages, they were making videos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel bad for ending early,
but... You went faster than you thought.
Well, there wasn't as much conversation as I thought, too.
Next time, you won't go as fast.